Jonathan Charles, hello, welcome to Your Public Value. You are the Managing Director for Communications at the EBRD, and we're very, very pleased to have you with us today to discuss public value and the new trends in the region that you operate in. So my first question to you, Jonathan, is what does public value mean to you?
Virginie, it's a pleasure to see you and to talk about this, because certainly pretty much my entire working life, I've worked in the public sector, doing something which I perceive to be for the common good, whether it was in my previous existence for 3 decades as a journalist at the BBC, the public sector broadcaster in the United Kingdom, or whether it's the past almost 9 years that I've spent at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which is heavily engaged on behalf of the international community in trying to do something that improves the lives of many people. So for me, my perception of public value is very much formed by my own working life. And I really perceive public value to be something for the public good, providing a public good, something that can only come from outside the private sector, because it requires very, very long-term engagement over a very long period of time in a way that only publicly funded institutions can, but with this ultimate goal of doing something which improves the public good. So public value, public good, in my mind, they're heavily connected.
Absolutely. But you and the bank advises a lot of businesses and governments in a pretty large region, and notably in countries in transition, where production is still predominant rather than sustainability. How can you bring this discourse to countries in transition?
So I think this is an interesting question, Virginie, because it's about the changing nature of what public value is and what public engagement or engagement by the public sector on an issue is. If I think back to 20 years ago, when the international community was helping emerging economies or helping poorer parts of the world economically, it was all about providing money and trying to help the public sectors in those countries. It's very clear now that in terms of public value, that is coming to an end. First of all, there is not the large amount of official money available to wealthier governments that they can just give to emerging economies and poorer economies and say, here you are, this will help you, we're giving you this for free. There just is not the money in the wealthier world available for governments to do that. So that has changed undoubtedly the context in which the EBRD operates. The European Bank for Reconstruction and Development was always set up from the very beginning to get these countries to change economically, initially in Central and Eastern Europe after the collapse of communism in the former Soviet Union, and then beyond that to other countries, including in recent years in the Middle East and North Africa. But the overarching aim was always the same: develop the market economies in these countries, develop the private sector as a way of improving the quality of people's lives, their opportunities, their potential for jobs, rather than relying on public sector money to do the job. Now, interestingly enough, we were perhaps a bit of an outlier 20 years ago, because all the emphasis was, if you really want to help, the public approach was to help the public sector in these countries. Now people recognize the only way to help these countries with long-term growth and jobs is to do what the EBRD is doing, which is to bring in private sector investment into these countries. That's the public value that we're now bringing, that we are changing things so that we try and bring in private sector investors. We use our own money to invest in developing the private sector, not the public sector. Because in the long term, the only way to deliver that public good that I was talking about, which I would perceive, for example, to be major economic change to improve the lives of citizens, action on climate change mitigation, the green economy, this cannot be done through large amounts of public money. There is just not the money available. But what institutions like the EBRD can do is to get the private sector to do some of the heavy lifting. So using a public institution like us to get the private sector to do the heavy lifting to deliver a public good.
Interesting. In a way, it's you're driven by similar considerations as responsible investors.
Yeah? Yes, there's definitely, I would say, a close correlation between the way that we are operating and what might be described as social impact investors.
Exactly.
So social impact investors obviously are trying to do a good. They're trying to do something which has a positive social impact, whilst at the same time, of course, they are making a profit out of it. In what we're doing, we are also operating to make a profit. We charge the people an interest rate, a commercial, in effect, interest rate, just as the commercial sector would do. That money then gets recycled back into more loans to help the public. But at our heart, we are attempting to deliver something which is socially positive. Therefore, there is a direct correlation. And interestingly enough, you know, we're often now invited to seminars on social impact investing because there is perceived to be a close relationship between the work of development banks like us and the private sector doing social impact investing.
Right. But in a way, the question remains identical. In the emerging economies, profit is very much the driving value.
Yes.
So it's, and we see that sustainability has often been forgotten, and that's where we have the main negative consequences for our planet. So what kind of discourse can you actually bring? Do you try to be coercive, or on the contrary, what's the position of the bank?
So I think it's definitely the case that the private sector in these countries, which, as you say, are heavily profit focused, need to understand that in being socially responsible, environmentally responsible, there is something in it for them. So it's not costing them. And the approach that we're taking, particularly, for example, on the green economy and climate mitigation, is to show them that it's a win-win situation. It's a win for the planet and it's a win for them. And let me give you a practical example, or a couple of practical examples of what that means. So we will often go along to a company and say, you are fantastically energy inefficient. That is costing you a lot of money. That is actually reducing your profitability. And by the way, it's also damaging the planet. Now, we will then come along with a solution that, for example, the use of renewable energies, the use of biomass fuels. We will go to them and say, let us invest with you. You know, you borrow the money and we will also work with you with our expertise as well to put in the technology into your company, which will allow you to use cleaner fuels, which in the long run will be cheaper for you as well. This will pay off. So you are going to have a medium to long-term benefit financially of doing this. And at the same time, of course, you're reducing your emissions and you are helping the green economy. So I think they have to see, and they are often persuaded by the economic and business argument, that this isn't just good for the planet, it's good business too. That's one example. To give you another example where we do a lot is in domestic energy use in people's homes, trying to get them to cut their emissions and make their homes greener and more environmentally sustainable. We run a lot of credit lines with local banks. So we lend the money to a local bank. They will lend it on then to tens of thousands of people, say at 500 or 1,000 euros a time, so people can make improvements to their home, which makes their home more sustainably, you know, but much better in sustainable terms, much greener. So energy efficient. Now, again, it's good for them because their energy bills come down over the medium term compared to what they have been paying, and they pay off their loans that way. At the same time, reducing the emissions is good for the planet. So people, I think, you know, sadly, one of the facts of life, people are motivated by their own self-interest. You have to appeal to that, but make it clear that in appealing to their self-interest, there is a public good that can come out of it.
Yes, and also maybe use the leverage of reputation, because eventually, if they are not with us...
I think more and more companies that we work with are seeing that. It wasn't always the case. You know, there were a lot of companies generally in the world that were willing, particularly in some of the emerging economies, where they were fighting for their survival often. They would say, no, the most important thing for us is the profit, reputation, we can worry about later. I do think now that they understand there is a need not just to be environmentally sustainable. You know, it's an education process which over the decades has clearly worked. But secondly, I think that they also understand increasingly a notion which has been around for a long time in more advanced economies of corporate social responsibility. That is starting to increasingly be the norm in many companies in for example, the former communist bloc where we were.
But corporate social responsibility a few years ago was still very much the cherry on the cake. Something to look nice and to look a bit modern, innovative, but absolutely not at the core of any corporate strategy. And we're talking public value is a lot more about corporate strategies.
Yes. I think that what's interesting in this area is, I think we've moved from a position where corporate social responsibility was very superficial.
Yes.
It was designed to give a nice gloss to a company, as you say, as opposed to actually delivering anything tangible. I think companies have moved way beyond that. And again, I think it's self-interest. First of all, they know their shareholders want it. They know it looks good for their reputation. But I think there's been a third driver as well, and that is in terms of recruitment into their workforces. That increasingly, with younger workers in particular, they're looking to go to companies that they feel good about working with and for. And if they don't see that reflected in really proper corporate social responsibility, something that is tangible, not just superficial, then actually companies realize they were losing out in terms of recruiting workers. Some of the best workers would go elsewhere because they want to feel that the company they work for is a place that is responsible. So I think there are many drivers of this, but it is definitely happening in more and more companies. We see that. And they're not just paying lip service to it, because I think what we originally saw, if you go back a decade or so, we saw a lot of companies, of course we have a corporate social responsibility policy, it's all in place, this is what we do. And then when you went into it, you thought, well, actually, you know, it's nice words.
Yes. Well, that's interesting. We, interestingly, are speaking quite a lot of the private sector. When I really was following the EBRD closely, when I used to work on the former Soviet Union, it was really about public institutions, as you mentioned, and it was about really fighting for multilateralism. Yeah. In this region, the former Soviet Union, not to mention the Kremlin in particular, the vision has always or often been a bit different, not so much as the need for multilateral relations, but very much a two-lens world in a way. So what I'm interested in is to understand what's the percentage of what the bank is doing today. Is it, you're saying it's a lot more about the private sector, but you're still working on multilateral relationships, I believe, yes?
Yeah, so if I think about, you know, I think all economic change over decades is a process. You know, and if you think about the countries where the EBRD first started working, first of all, they didn't have the necessary institutions in place. A lot of them have been swept away by political change. So a lot of the early days of the EBRD was about putting into place the foundations that you could build a private sector economy on, those institutions, the rule of law. That was something that was very important for investors and needed to be worked on. I think now, while those things are still important, you know, we believe very strongly in institution building and the rule of law. They are the foundation of why investors will go to one country rather than another. That increasingly, you know, our work is in developing the real private sector. And about, well, I know so far this year, about 80% of our investment, to give you an example, is in the private sector. It is about getting those small and medium-sized companies that can be the backbone of economic change, that can provide growth and jobs in countries which really desperately need it. You know, I travel a lot to our countries, not just in Central and Eastern Europe or Central Asia or the Caucasus, but also in the Middle East, North Africa. You know, the cry there is for jobs. People want jobs, and they know they will only come through strong, small and medium-sized enterprises on the whole. They won't come through public sector employment. So we are, you know, you quite legitimate question to ask, for example, on what public sector work we do in that 20%. A lot of it is about providing the infrastructure that the private sector will eventually need. For example, it's no good saying to the private sector, come to our country, come to country X, country Y, if they can't move their goods around because actually the road network or rail network is in a terrible state. So that 20% tends to be a lot of it going into making sure the basic infrastructure is as good as it can possibly be, so the private sector can actually grow, invest and thrive. The other issue you raise is the question of multilateralism.
Yes.
Now, obviously, it's not just the fact that we work with the governments of the countries where we invest, but all those governments are also shareholders. They are shareholders in the EBRD. You know, we are owned by 67 countries, plus a shareholding owned by the European Union and the European Investment Bank. So multilateralism has always been the basis of the EBRD. We live in a world, though, obviously, now, as we, you know, we live it every day, where multilateralism is under tremendous pressure.
We
see it all the time. Even if I think back to a decade ago, there was much more common purpose in the world, where governments could agree on some things, no matter what sort of government they were, and they agreed to work on them. I think clearly that's under strain. We see it in many relationships. You know, what we see is in the America-China relationship over trade. We see it in the UK Brexit issues. We've seen it over some issues around Russia. You know, so there are many different issues. It's not just about one region of the world or one country having issues with multilateralism. Generally, we seem to be moving away from a passionate belief in multilateralism, from a completely committed belief in multilateralism, so that you know, governments would do it without having to think about it, to one where there is almost a ratcheting effect. We believe in multilateralism if there's something in it for us. We go back to this self-interest question, which we talked about earlier. So I think governments are taking on the whole, even though they may not always recognize it, much more of a self-interested view on multilateralism and whether to work together on certain issues. I think personally that's a shame. You know, I believe multilateralism is key to resolving many of those public value provision issues that we talk about. They can only happen through multilateralism. You know, we can name all the issues we all know, you know, climate change. That's clearly only going to happen through multilateral action, mitigation of climate change.
All right. Well, that's really interesting. Jonathan, time is coming to an end. I just wanted to ask you one last question, a little bit more practical. When one of these companies, be it small, medium size, or a corporation, comes to you or to the bank a bit overwhelmed, not really knowing where to start, you know, sustainability is such a huge thing, and the future depends on how we're driving our own business. What is the natural reaction of the bank? What do you think corporations should start with?
You know, when we first started, we believed very strongly in examples that actually change would come in countries through showing people examples of successful change in their own country. So when a company comes to us and says, we don't really know how to begin on this green issue. Well, obviously we have a fair amount of expertise and we can guide them through. But I personally think the best way is to say, well, you know, Mr. or Mrs. X, your company produces Y. We've had another company in your country which has done something similar, and this is what we did for them. And I think that demonstration effect is really important in getting people to change. I think we live in a world where people are increasingly less willing to accept intangible answers, theoretical answers. They want to see the tangible. So I think you can only persuade people into a certain course of action, nudge them into a certain course of action, if it's a question of reform of their company or a country, by showing them tangible examples. And I think that's what we've got to do. We have to say we have the case studies, we have the tangible examples, it works.
So it's less of the moral best practice as we used to bring, and more what to do and what works.
I think, again, in this world, we are moving to that tangible. You know, people don't want a theoretical-based approach. They want the practical, the tangible.
And I suppose,
you know, the good thing is, and the very good thing is, we are, at least from the EBRD's experience now, talking about almost, 30 years experience.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, in 2021, it'll be 30 years experience. So I think that at least is on our side. The world may have moved to a more tangible position, but we are in a position to be more tangible as a bank because we've got 30 years of experience of case studies in a way that would not have been possible. We couldn't have engaged with companies in the world in the same way in 1991. We didn't have then the track record, the case studies, the history.
Yeah, and the environment was also very different.
And that's the other thing as well. I think that it's very important that, you know, for public value, that public sector or international community organizations like us, that we are flexible and fleet of foot and able to adapt to what is a very fast moving world. Because I think there's often a perception that organizations in the public sphere just cannot do that. Well, we make it a habit of doing that because, I mean, I think we've got the private sector mentality, even though we're a public sector organization. We have to be like the people that we're trying to help. I think, though, it's the only way to survive for organizations in the public sphere. If you can't be fleet of foot in this fast world, it's going to be very difficult.
Very nice conclusion. I want to thank you, Jonathan, for your time and sharing your thoughts with us.
It's an absolute pleasure to do that.
We'll be in touch, of course, and I wish you great success.
Thank you very much indeed, Virginie.
Thank you.